top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
Strange case. No sign of violence, yet she looks completely contorted in fear. Almost as if she'd been frightened to death. As if she'd seen something too horrible to live through.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
The science fiction classic, The Incredible Shrinking Man, one of the best sci-fi films of all time.
Scarlett, what was that?
I don't know. Some kind of mist.
Look at your chest. Still too loose?
Sure, even the cuffs are dragging.
They do look kind of big.
I'm getting smaller, Lou, every day.
Well, that's silly, honey. People just don't get smaller.
There's no medical precedent for what's happening to you. I simply know that you're getting smaller. The x-rays prove it beyond any doubt.
Are you going out?
Yes, for a little while.
Where?
Well, just to the corner, to the store.
You'll come right back?
Well, of course I will.
An innovative film featuring fantastic special effects.
Charlie, maybe he's hurt someplace. Maybe he's lost.
We've looked everywhere.
With these bits of metal, I was a man again. If I was to die, it would not be as a helpless insect in the jaws of the spider monster.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 232, The Incredible Shrinking Man. The Incredible Shrinking Man is an absolute sci-fi classic based on the Richard Matheson novel, The Shrinking Man. Now, Matheson is also known for penning an especially memorable episode of The Twilight Zone, where an airplane passenger is menaced by this creepy gremlin that appears to him on the wing. In the window of the seat. It wasn't that episode, but it was actually Twilight Zone, the movie's treatment of it, that scared the living bejesus out of me as a kid. Matheson also adapted his short story Duel, which Steven Spielberg turned into arguably one of the greatest made-for-TV movies of all time. In the 50s, the likes of Matheson, Ray Bradbury, etc. were considered pulp. So it's kind of ironic that these stories, which were not only clever in their own right, but provided fantastic fodder for film adaptations.
And Jack Arnold directed it, and he's the man who directed The Wonderful It Came From Outer Space. And he really contributed to this film in an incredible way, which I'll mention later. And this is a Universal picture. So when you think Universal, you think horror. Like, you know, your Dracula, your Frankenstein, your Wolfman, what have you. They ruled the matinee from the 30s straight on into, I would say, the late 50s, around the time this came out. Now, this is not considered to be a canonical Universal horror. It's not really a horror. It's more sci-fi. And I think it was considered to be more of a B-movie. Even though, it's to me, this is a prestige picture. But I think it's because it's not a monster movie, for one thing. So that's one bit of an anomaly from, like, what Universal... Because, you know, at this time, Universal was still putting out the Monster Mash movies to film the matinees, you know, Dracula. Dracula meets Frankenstein meets Abbott and Costello, whatever. And also, I think this probably played drive-in. So it kind of had that pedigree of being a B-movie, but it's...
Well, I guess no marquee lead in the role as well.
Well, there's that, although he acquitted himself very well. Mm-hmm. Do you recall his name? Or
No, not at all, which speaks to that point. But, yeah, it's amazing for something so unheralded. I mean, the whole genre was unheralded, with the exception of H.G. Wells and the Ray Bradbury. It's that's probably why Stephen King feels such Carlin affinity Ellison. For them. Ellison, to a certain extent, Isaac Asimov, but they don't have a lot of critical acclaim. H.P. Lovecraft, too. It's still treated as, like, stepson.
Yeah.
Like,
I would put Lovecraft more in the horror genre, even though there are sci-fi elements.
Yeah, but ironically, it's movies like this that have the most profound impact. I was thinking about this when I started watching it. Like, A, how original it is, and B, considering how many thousands of people we've seen killed on screen, I was more affected by the predicament of the main character here, which I thought was really interesting. And for this is, again, just such a simple plot that you associate with horror movies, where you have the plot is in the title, as is here, but there's so much, there's almost existential dread.
Oh, not almost, it was there. It was there.
Which is unbelievable.
See, that's the whole thing. And I mean, this film is a prime example of how genre movies can explore so many deep philosophical issues, existential issues, even theological issues. And I mean, there's so much to unpack in this movie. And it starts off with, you would almost say it's a MacGuffin. You know, you got a couple.
Oh, the radiation.
Yeah, radiation mixed with insecticide.
You know? Oh, I didn't even notice
like
that.
They're having a vacation. The husband's name, the wife's name is Louise, and the husband's name is Scott
Carey. Scott Carey, yeah.
And they're on a boat in some unnamed ocean, and they're just enjoying some leisure time, and all of a sudden, Louise goes inside to get something, and this mist engulfs Scott, and they come back home, and things start to really change for Scott. The first thing he notices is that his clothes start to feel a bit loose. Okay, maybe he lost some weight. But as time goes on, he's noticing that he's actually getting smaller.
Which is pretty funny. It's, I guess, the hull of the ship. I guess the insecticide / radioactive mist didn't broach the hull. And she's fine.
Well, there was The Incredible Shrinking Woman. That came out in 1981. And it featured Lily Tomlin. And I remember, because this was the early days of VHS, when, before your Blockbusters, when you would have a mom-and-pop shop. Ours was called Video Flicks. And whatever they had in their big clamshell boxes, you took home and rented. So exactly. I saw some really interesting films. In fact, I believe that my mother rented me the infamous racist Disney film, The Song of the South, because that was available for rental back then before Disney decided to expunge it from our collective memories, which nobody has forgotten about.
Thanks, James Gunn.
Exactly, indeed. And that's just, I don't even want to go into the whole James Gunn thing because I'm so angry about that. But like,
oh, you made your point, yeah.
Look, James Gunn is one of us, okay? The guy cut his teeth at Troma, okay? Exactly. It was a different color. Oh, anyway, whatever. I don't want to go further than that. But so I remember one of the movies my mother rented, and I remember the cover looked really appealing, a little tiny Lily Tomlin on top of this giant gorilla, was The Incredible Shrinking Woman, and yet it was so, it didn't even hold the attention of me at like 4 years old, you know, 5 years old.
Lily Tomlin, like her fame was so mystifying to me.
Well, we didn't.
She had this routine where she answered this phone.
But that's something neither you and I watch Laugh In, so we don't really.
I know, but like, there's some gimmick about answering the phone. Like, I don't know. Like, this so like true comedy stands the test of time, and Monty Python will be as funny 50 years hence.
But there's a way that I'm going to be honest with you right now, because I feel that way, and you feel that way. But I don't think millennials are digging Monty Python at all. Like my students. They think it's boring. Thing is
really like the argument sketch where I came in here for an argument. No, you didn't. Yes, you did. Like the guy who pays for an argument.
It
with John Cleese.
It's too conceptual.
Too clever.
There's a lot of allegory and illusion, mostly illusion. Like for example, my favorite Monty Python sketches is a soccer match with the philosophers.
The philosophers, yeah.
And they're too busy, you know, pontificating to actually kick a ball. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Could be proven to be wrong. The staying power of Seinfeld has proven rather robust.
That is true.
But then again, Cheers has not. So who knows what could happen. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, getting back to the film. Obviously he's concerned and he's going to the doctor. And at first the doctor's trying to say, you know, rationalize it. Okay, you've gone from 6'1" to 5'11". You've lost 10 pounds. Not a big deal. But he keeps on shrinking.
And people don't get shorter, as the doc points out. Although they do when they age, but that's just nitpicking. Mm-hmm. So they run him through a battery of tests. The Geiger counter, of course, you got to put that beside him to see how much radiation he's absorbed. Iodine, but they're just mystified.
My favorite line is when Scott says, I'll call the doctor in the morning. I'm sure he's got a pill for it.
Mm.
Like, Pill. You know, in order for a drug manufacturer to manufacture a pill,
not to mention testing it,
billions of dollars in R&D, it would have to be some widespread condition they can then advertise on TV. Do you suffer from premature shrinking syndrome? This is one man on one planet. Yeah. This is not a common ailment. Anyhow, as he gets smaller and smaller, at one point he can barely peer over the window, and the effects are incredible. Forget about, I mean, obviously they're using a lot of forced perspective.
For sure.
And of course, gigantic props and whatnot. And, you know, a lot of these effects were utilized by Peter Jackson in the Lord of the Rings trilogy to make the hobbits look really small. But the effects are incredible. And so he becomes this tiny little man that can barely peer over his window. And not only that, but because he's such a scientific anomaly, he becomes a freak.
And he has some kinship with the traveling circus show, which features obviously the 3-foot woman with whom he has a drink in a restaurant. So he finds his crew.
Well, he becomes angry and bitter, and he does join the circus, and you know his relationship is falling apart with his wife because she's regular size and he's becoming smaller and smaller by the day. And then, and at one point he's talking on the phone, and the phone is massive, it's amazing. But then his relationship with this small woman at the circus suffers because at first, when they first meet, she goes, oh, you're taller than me. And then when they meet for the next time, he's shorter than her. And he is just completely beside himself to the point that he ultimately accepts his fate and lives in a dollhouse. He ends up living in a dollhouse.
Yeah, and that's it. Just shows that everything's relative. I guess if there's some hierarchy everywhere, I don't know. Like this, it wasn't explicit that she dumped him, but he was so tough on himself.
He just walked away. He walked away
realizing that he can't even be several inches taller than the smallest woman in his dating market, if you want to put it that way. So he's just. He realizes this isn't. There's no end to this plight.
Well, he does contemplate suicide, but the will to survive perseveres, and where this film really becomes something special is when he finds himself lost in the basement and has to survive. And not only does he have to clothe himself, because at this point he's minuscule, right? Not only does he have to clothe himself, feed himself, but he has to survive against predators. One being a cat, his cat.
Yeah, and the other great being, cat scares. I'm not accustomed to those. Really good ones here.
And the other being, this is extended set piece where it's him versus a spider, and it is riveting, just riveting, incredible. He's using a knitting needle as his weapon, and the thing looks like a lance. It's incredible, just incredible.
Yeah, and so it's basically he's trying to capture the attention of his brother and his I guess his do wife. I want to say ex-wife, I guess still wife, and he's stuck in the basement, and each step has become just this insurmountable giant obstacle because he's 3-4 inches each step is foot high. It's really amazing.
And it should be mentioned that his wife thinks he's dead because they saw some evidence that led them to believe that the cat killed him. So he's down there hoping, praying that they're going to come down one day and rescue him, but that's not a guarantee. So I don't want to spoil the ending of this film, but once you get past the absolutely incredible special effects, once you get past the very novel story, this film ends up becoming so existential, metaphysical, theological, and almost life-affirming that without spoiling the ending, It leaves me slack-jawed every time I see it.
Agreed, because whenever you have this deus ex machina of radiation, it's typically directed toward the animal kingdom, and you can't relate. You can't put yourself in the headspace of this is first-person experience in a way. This is a human being smaller. Like this is not a spider being increased in size, or the typical like a crab. They attack the crab people, or one of these 50s. Radiation-induced monster movies. This is an actual person, and that's so much more affecting. I was personally like affected by this.
And the other thing too, I should say is a lot of this film, the exposition is delivered through narration, and I without having read the source material, I believe that was taken verbatim from Bradbury's, because it was so lyrical and poetic and metaphorical. You know, the chasm, and he's talking about like just maybe like not even a half a foot leap spread out before me, like, and there's just similes and metaphors going on. absolutely incredible. But what's amazing is that the what most people remember this film for is the final soliloquy, which is, as I said before, metaphysical, existential, theological, and life-affirming. And that was actually written by Jack Arnold. This film is a prime exemplar of how so-called lesser art can explore themes in a way better than so-called high art. Because what we've got going on here is... And this is when you take away all the sci-fi trap. I mean, just as a matinee movie, in the imagine being a kid, 8 years old. Your mother drops you off at the cinema to see a double bill, okay, in 1957. And the first film that spools is this one. And you're watching this battle between this little tiny man and the spider transpiring on the big screen for the first time. I can't imagine not being completely just blown away and, like, your mind almost picked up in, like, almost... blown into a million pieces you have to pick up off the floor. It would, as a kid, it would make me absolutely just like, holy fuck, what am I seeing, you know?
Well, I mean, it's got to be up there with one of the top 10 alienation movies. It's so austere. It's so... and yet
sorry, Alienation? Like, yeah, the actual series, Alienation?
Oh, my God.
With, no, Mandy Patinkin and...
No, but... just
Alien?
Of,
do you mean Alien or...
Alienation?
Alienation was a movie.
No, I mean Alienation.
I think because Alienation, two words, is a movie that starred, I believe it was Mandy Patinkin, and then it was made into a TV series in the late 80s, and I enjoyed both. Maybe one day we'll do Alienation on the podcast. It was actually a very cool movie.
I was thinking like maybe either 2001 or, oh, what's that other one? Something Earth. Damn, it's escaped my mind, but it's amazing that you can have so much scale and alienation in one house. Essentially, everything took place in a basement, and yet it felt like
in
some
a suburban
expanse.
White picket fence home, yeah. And yeah, totally, because, I mean, alienation, indeed. I mean, I wrote down loneliness and isolation, but that's what, yeah, because that is explored in this movie, because here you have a man living in a world patently not made for him in any way, shape, or form, and he's very bitter as he's becoming smaller and things are becoming harder for him to do. But when he's in the basement, minuscule, I mean, all of a sudden we are exploring the human instinct to survive at all costs, using whatever resources are at hand in order to live, even though his quality of life is terrible. I mean, he's fighting a life or death battle to get a little tiny piece of stale cheese off a mousetrap. And then you also have man versus beast. You have, you know, kill or be killed. I mean, there's so much going on that... And then when it ends the way it does with that amazing epiphany, I would say, experienced by a character, that's all I'm going to say. It is just a work of art. There's not much more I could say. It's a work of art. And I'm so happy that they decided to expand this property by making a shitty-ass Lily Tomlin spinoff, the Incredible Shrinking Woman, rather than remaking this. Because this is perfect as it is.
What about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Well, I've never seen that, actually. All I know is that it came out in the best summer for movies in the history of my life, 1989. That was the best summer of all time. Next year, oh my God, it's the 30th anniversary of that summer. But
wow, oh my God, flies.
We might have to do a summer of 89 retrospective next year, because that was the amount of wonderful movies, genre, and otherwise that came out that summer. Just incredible. And embarrassment riches. I've never seen any of the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movies. Not this, nor Honey, I Shrunk the Parents. I don't know. They made a few sequels.
But it sucks all the life out of it. When you have some mad scientist and you play it for yucks instead of with existential dread, I assume that's the plot. I have no idea. I've never seen it either. But yeah, I remember Rick Moranis in the poster.
Well, the whole thing about shrinking, I mean, it's been used before. Fantastic Voyage, right? Where they go into the body. Isn't that what the...
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, of course, they paid homage to that in one of my favorite television series, Rick and Morty. Where they in their Anatomy Park episode, so and of course, and there are superheroes that shrink, so like the Atom and stuff, but nothing like this, where it's
In that situation, it's advantageous, right?
Exactly. So because they can shrink, and then they can, and Ant-Man, of course, and they can then become regular size again. Yeah. So it's not like they're doomed to live their whole life in this just terrible state.
Well, it really plays on your sympathy and your empathy, and it makes you question really what you would do in that condition.
And that's what's amazing.
What would you do? You always see people who are overcoming circumstances that you can't possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. You face your own health challenges, but then you see someone who's maybe has to be carted around in a wheelchair, who's maybe missing the lower part of their torso or their legs, and you go, "What? How does that person continue?" And really, I guess, if you have your mental faculties, then you're able to continue. At least you have your imagination. Yeah. You have engagement with your fellow man. But let me
say a few things. I mean, because that is what really makes this film so profound. Because yes, at one point he did sort of, in a very 1950s way, allude to contemplating suicide, but then he realized that he's going to survive at all costs. And his resourcefulness in that basement, I don't know if I would be able to do what he did in order to survive. And it speaks to the human innate ability to just keep going, regardless of whatever adverse circumstances are thrown in our way.
I suppose so. Tom Hanks had his beach ball on the island. With whom can this guy interact? Can you possibly continue?
I'm going to talk right now about something about myself that, you know, I don't reveal to that many people, but I'm going to reveal it now. I struggle with depression, right? I may have revealed that on, like, the Tom Ernst podcast and what have you. Depression, and, you know, let's not even say I struggle with it. I cope with it. Depression, anxiety, what have you. And I've had my ups and my downs throughout my life. And thankfully, everything is stable right now, despite the fact that my life is facing a tremendous upheaval, but it doesn't matter. And there are times in my life when I was suicidal. And that's why it really, really affects me when, I mean, I guess the last one was Bourdain, Anthony Bourdain, but, like, you know, you're Robin Williams, you're Chris Cornell, or, you know, even if I don't like the guy, like the guy from Linkin Park, Chester Bennington. I mean, the ones that commit suicide. Because I was there. I know what it feels like. I know how it feels like to stare into the abyss of life and have nothing to look forward to other than maybe sleep, which is like your only respite from your suffering. And then you wake up and you're like, fuck, you know? But the one thing that, why am I still alive right now? And why will I continue on? Because the one thing I've never lost, and this is what our character in this movie never lost, hope. Hope is what makes everything happen. As long as you maintain that little glimmer of hope that things will get better, and believe me, if any of our listeners are contemplating anything drastic like that, or are suffering from depression or anxiety or anything, take it from somebody that has gotten through it and can give you some advice from the other side, it gets better. You just need to persevere long enough for it to get better. It's like walking through a door. All of a sudden, you walk through a door and everything changes. And it's amazing, and it's life-affirming, and you're better off as a human being than you were before. So I'm actually grateful for my suicidal thoughts and my episodes of depression, because it's made me a stronger, more resilient person, and that's why I'm going through a lot of personal upheavals right now, and I'm able to just deal with it, whereas in the past, I would probably be curled up in a field position on the ball and not being able to handle shit, you know what I mean? I won't go into that many more details, but yeah, there's things in my life that are happening right now that are, you know, pretty fundamentally, profoundly changing.
And so these details will be unfurled very gradually.
Probably, yeah.
I guess the Socratic purpose-driven life. Think of it, you know, almost remind yourself, like every few months, what your purpose is to just be. And that's tough, but it's essential. You can't, I mean, everyone needs something.
That sounds like a Degrassi junior high.
Everybody wants something. Without purpose, you're just stranded
purpose
in a mire.
And hope. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't tell me that
I can't say the two can be disentangled.
You can't tell me that Chris Cornell didn't have purpose. He was an incredible musician. I mean, maybe he wasn't writing the best songs of his career at this point, but the man was able to, you know, still belt it out. But, or that Robin Williams didn't have purpose. They lost hope.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the hope, man. It's just the hope. You lose that, you've lost everything. Take it from me. Like I said, I've been there and I've come out the other end. It's amazing that through examining a so-called genre film, we're now discussing a very important topic, which is, you know, mental illness and, you know, contemplations of suicide. But, I mean, you know, when I went on the Tom Ernst podcast, I was extremely nakedly vulnerable talking about this sort of stuff. And at first I was a little bit reticent, like, how much do I really want to reveal about myself? But then I thought to myself, if my struggles and my story can help one person, just one person, who is struggling to maintain that hope and live another day and maybe even get through it, holy shit, man, you've saved a life.
Mm-hmm. So, on that happy note, no, what did we learn?
It is happy, Chris, because I'm still here.
I agree.
And I'm enjoying life. And that's the whole thing. I mean, if I would have taken my life because I was so full of suffering, and I mean, like, you know, and when you're suffering, the analogy I give is you're in the shit, and all you can smell is shit, right? And there could be a bed of roses right next to you, but all you're going to smell is the shit. Don't think of Bon Jovi right now.
All
you can smell is the
shit. Yeah, exactly.
But ultimately, you're going to smell those roses, and they're going to smell sweeter because you spent, you know, however long you did in the shit, you know? So it is a happy note because I'm still kicking, man, and I'm still, and I'm better than I ever was. So
good to hear.
Yeah. I hope that this, you know, conversation is not too much of a downer. I hope that it's helpful to somebody. So, I guess on that note, let's talk about what we learned.
Well, this came at a perfect time because I was kind of going down the rabbit hole of watching radiation documentaries. So I was watching something about an old Soviet Union test site where they used to blow up hydrogen bombs, and it's in present-day Kazakhstan. And just the alienation and the desolation of just nothing for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kilometers, and knowing that that is essentially what is going to be here when human life ceases to exist, which will be at a certain time. I was reading a book by an astronomer named Phil Plait, who writes the Bad Astronomy blog, and it's really terrific, and it's about the end of the world. And he talked about how in 65 million years ago, an asteroid the size of Everest hit the Earth and created this incredible fire that wiped the dinosaurs out. And this, I thought, okay, the alienation, no humans left, nothing, no one to talk to, who's here, what is life, what is its meaning? And then I watched The Incredible Shrinking Man, and this guy is essentially placed in the same predicament. He's alienated completely from everyone around him. He's the last of his kind. The only of his kind. The last man on Earth. It always seems to be on TV. For what? And there's no one he can talk to.
The basic instinct to survive at all costs. I guess. It doesn't matter. The hope. It's all about hope. That maybe...
maybe someone else is in his predicament.
But at the end of the day, he accepts his lot in life with grace and aplomb. So, I mean, it's a very life-affirming movie.
Yeah.
I think I spent a lot of this podcast talking about what I learned. I mean, the sense that I love these movies that are like Trojan horses. You think that they're just, you know, matinee, fodder, genre fare, and yet they are so profound. And this is one of those movies. And this is why I love genre.
Oh, you know? Yeah. And just think if they had taken the other tack, then it would have been almost a Frankenstein in its approach. If they did The Incredible Growing Man, then you have...
The attack of the 50-foot woman. I mean, it may be...
Yeah, but it doesn't have that same impact. I mean, I guess you're treated differently. For one thing, you can't be missed, whereas the essential conceit here is that you're lost. If you're really lost in both senses of the word. You're 3 inches tall. Mm-hmm. You are lost, as opposed to the 50-foot woman. They can see her all the time. They can interact with her.
Yeah.
This is just disappearing into becoming a non-entity.
Yeah, so no,
that's heavy, heavy-duty stuff.
It's very, very heavy-duty stuff. My star rating is 4.5 stars. The only reason I'm not giving it 5 stars is, even though it's a short movie, it's 80 minutes long, it feels a bit longer. It's some sense, it's a very lugubrious movie. It does drag a bit, but it's worth it. It's the destination is so worth the journey. So 4.5 stars for me, veering towards 5.
Yeah, I would say 4, just because of the slight overuse of voiceover, which had its... debits and it's positive. So at some point it was really, really compelling, but other times I thought it was filler. But yeah, it's undeniable. I would say 4.25 even.
In many ways it reminded me of Vincent Price's Last Man on Earth, like in terms of just the narration and so on, because that was suitably poetic narration as well, just like this one.
But even that, I mean, if you're the last person on Earth, you can get a sense of your alienation. But here he's doomed to not being able to find his people.
And there is no people. He has no people.
He has no people, but he knows there are people, but he can't find them, as opposed to knowing there are no people. So, it's just like, you know, splitting hairs.
He has no people that are the same as him. So he is an anomaly. In a planet, I mean, back in 57, there wasn't 7 billion inhabitants. I don't know how many there were. Probably a few billion less, but he was a one-of-a-kind anomaly. So, having said that,
check out our one-of-a-kind podcast. New episodes every Friday for your listening pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.